Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk, and you can find out more at my website, allbook-books.com, and check out the Substack page, Musings from Between the Lines. This week, a further look into the chapter about the Spanish Catholicism and their part in the colonial ceremonies of domination. From Patricia Seed's book, Ceremonies of Possession, Europe's Conquest of the New World, 1492 to 1640. So a lot of times I try to be concise and get to the point and keep it a little bit shorter time-wise so that people will listen more. But this time I'm not going to push it because this chapter is so chock-full and I found it amazingly interesting. And even though I knew some of it, some of it's just mind-blowing, and I want to extrapolate on those bits. First of all, I want to say that, like, for years, I felt like in the U.S., much of the way things work is that people don't want to change as much because of the comfort zone. And when they have their, you know, their particular bennies or whatever, it's hard to change because, you know, it feels so good. So lo and behold, some of this goes back not only to the Spanish colonizers, but to the Islamic tradition, because that's one of the highlights in this chapter, is that the rewards for submission that were part of the requirement that was put forth to the natives and indigenous peoples was if you submit to His Majesty and Lord our God, then we'll treat you okay. Then we'll give you some rewards. But if you don't submit, then there'll be war, and then your children and your wives will be enslaved and blah, blah, blah. So that insane formula there is a subtle effect on the U.S. today, I think, and why there's these rewards for submission, what I call the Empire Light, because there's the goodies, the looty bags. And that, some of that coming from the Islamic tradition, because that's, I had read that years ago, Islam means submission to word, the word means submission or submission to Allah. So in a spiritual religious sense, there's a submission to a higher, more cosmic power. I go along with that. But when it's total submission, without the individual having their own say, then I think it becomes religion, because I've learned that through my journey thus far with the Kabbalah as part of my spiritual path, that like God, the gods or God or spirits, they don't want yes men. They want that sometimes, but they want people to not fight back, but to spar, to wrestle. They want people to say, hey, what do you want? Not just do what we tell you to do, but what do you want? Which that's a whole deep conversation there. But the point I'm trying to make is that this whole thing of submission becomes, I think it in the long run, it leads to this mindlessness of following, which is much of what is the issue, and that is even one of the roots of the word society, is to follow. So anyway, I'll get into some of this. This speech called the requirement, requerimiento, was the principal means by which Spaniards enacted political authority over the New World during the era of their most extensive conquest, 1512 to 1573. Read aloud to the New World natives from a written text. The requirement was an ultimatum for Indians to acknowledge the superiority of Christianity or be warred upon. So it's the superiority, and that's the submission, is to, you know, to be below someone else. So these people, these colonizers, they sort of took on that Islamic stuff, and then they twisted it even further. Then the requirement was thus both a military and a political ritual, but as a ritual for declaring war, it was uniquely Spanish, having no parallel in any other European culture. The French, they sought to have an alliance and to bring the native people into the ritual, as was shown in the previous episode chapter. But here, the Spanish are saying they're not trying to have an alliance. They're saying you got to do this. We're talking about the Arab world and what it could and did devise most effectively was a policy of ruling over conquered people, a great many elements of which would be imitated by the Spaniards in their conquest of the New World. From its early years on, Islam did not separate political from religious rule. Here's a quote, "Government and religion are two brothers, neither can stand without the other." It was a popular saying from the second or third century of the Islamic Empire. And it gets into the word jihad. Which again, after 9/11, when I looked that up, the root of the word really means struggle, to struggle with oneself. Again, that's that wrestling with spirit to find your way. But the jihad became to be this war imposed on other people for not bowing down to the religion. That's the extremist part of the jihad. In another way would be just, you know, fighting as a last resort. That would be, you know, maybe in self-defense. But the aggressive jihad is another level to it. In the Iberian Islamic tradition, the purpose of the summons was to invite the person to accept Islam. So this is part of their requirement, the summoning, the imploring, the demanding. According to Islamic tradition, the Prophet Muhammad would write to those against whom he was starting a jihad. "Now then, I invite you to Islam, surrender," and in parentheses, "surrender to Allah." The word Islam itself means submission, sometimes translated surrender. Submission signifies a recognition of superiority. According to Islamic tradition, Muhammad used the word aslim, submit to us, Islam, in his summons. So what was at first a personal Muhammad submitting to a higher spirit then turned into the religion, which then turned into what was politically, religiously forced upon other people to submit to the other peoples from somewhere else in the name of the crown and a higher power. And Muslim means one who submits, one who believes. And what they were going for is, here's a quote, was uncoerced conversion. Uncoerced conversion. So by asking, you know, saying, hey, this is what we want you to do, otherwise we're going to do war, they were going for the uncoerced conversion. Muhammad forced no one to join his belief so long as they remained subject. He forced them no further. I see this with the U.S. Empire and the assimilation tactics. Another tactic was not to really conquer, because they wanted to be able to use the lands and control the lands. So not just they would let the people have their this and that, the kind of rewards of submission, but they wouldn't totally take it over because they still wanted to somehow use the lands, which is going on today as a lot of native lands in the U.S. are still being, you know, mined for the resources and the money. To recognize the superiority of Islam concretely signified a ritual humiliation, and there's an annual tax called the jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A. So that was part of the deal too, was okay, now you're under the submission, and so you gotta pay up to keep us protecting you, and you know, you pay up and then we won't bother you too much, which is kind of like, you know, I see that playing out in the U.S. tax system, you know, hey, you know, once a year, give them some money and then they won't bother you, that kind of thing. Payment of jizya created an economic motive for Islamic states not to have subject peoples convert immediately, since upon conversion they would no longer be liable for payment of the poll tax. Hence, Islamic rulers did not want quick conversions for either economic or religious reasons. In most schools of Islamic jurisprudence, jizya was, I don't know if I pronounced that, but jizya was collected only from believers in monotheistic religions, Jews, Christians, or Zoroastrians, often called collectively, quote, people of the book. On the Iberian Peninsula, conquering Muslims imposed jizya upon Christians and Jews. So the other thing, quite the clusterfuck of the Abrahamic religions is another highlight that I got out of this chapter. They were disagreeing with each other, taxing each other, fighting with each other, using each other's thing. Eventually, the Spanish disavowed. At the end of the chapter, she explains how they wanted to distance themselves from Islamic influence because Islam was then an enemy. So they changed the language from submission to obedience and vassalage. Queen Isabel declared that her aim was to impose a tax she called tribute upon New World natives. The Indians were, quote, subjects and vassals of the crown, she declared, and as such are to pay us tributes and rights, sentiments that would be repeated again and again in instructions for ruling the New World. Every day when you go buy something, guess what you're doing? You're paying tax. Some of that, perhaps helps the community, paves the roads, this and that. But for the most part, I would say people don't know and don't really care where the tax money is going. It's just part of the total of the purchase. Many people do care in the bigger picture that a huge amount of tax goes to the military-industrial complex. So that's another layer. But again, this whole thing about domination, Indians who were pacified and reduced to our obedience pay tribute. Payments were declared to be in recognition of lordship or superiority. So that's why, as Stephen Newcomb mentioned to me, that they're ceremonies of domination, because it's not just possessing the land or the resources. They are the vehicle for that was through dominating the people. This tax was the central, unique economic feature of Spanish dominion over New World peoples. No other colonial power imposed a per capita tax on indigenous peoples, let alone one initially levied on men of fighting age. And then it goes into tribute in cash, but poorer ones, almost often the Muslim, paid with their labor. So that makes me think of the fast forward to the sweatshops and slave labor. So again, this book is amazing me because of all the ways that these behavioral societal patterns that were imposed are still playing out in this so-called modern world. And another amazing connection to the U.S., according to the Encyclopedia of Islam, up on the conquest of a non-Muslim country by Muslims, the population which does not embrace Islam and which is not enslaved is guaranteed life, liberty, and in a modified sense, property. Life, liberty, and in a modified sense, property. Haven't traced that, but that sure sounds like where the so-called founders of this country got that from. The rewards for submission. If you bow down to us, we will give you life. We won't take it with a war, and we will give you liberty, ignoring that you were naturally free before that, and the property, a place to live, or as it became, a pursuit of happiness, not even the guarantee of happiness, but we'll give you a chance. And these were the terms of the surrender of Christians to Muslims in 713 AD on the Iberian Peninsula. So fast forward to the Spanish Christians and Catholicism in the 1500s, and fast forward to nowadays and the U.S. Yeah, here's the footnote where I got that phrase, which is one of my top summaries for the chapter. In the 17th century, the rewards for submission continued to be elaborated by Spanish authorities. Exemption from the requirement to labor and from tribute for 10 years. So this rewards of, now when I think of rewards for submission, then I think two of my core of my personal, my path is the non-religious Kabbalah, which Kabbalah means a personally received teaching. So to allow someone to have a personally received teaching is basically the opposite of rewards for submission. You submit to us, and we will give you the rewards is what's imposed from the outside, whereas with the Kabbalah, it's you listen to the spirits and you do the work, and then you'll get some rewards. They're not doled out. Those are genuinely earned rewards, and they are earned from one's own personal effort, and those rewards are meant for that specific person. So what I personally receive may be helpful to someone else, but certain things that I personally receive with the path of Kabbalah are specifically meant for me and how I am supposed to be and behave and such like. So that is not something that is imposed en masse on people, which is what has become to dominate the world scene. On billions of people, these ceremonies of domination have been imposed, and it's squelching the other access, people's own access to their own inherent power and intuition and divine guidance. And I also see this as like this, I see this as a projection of religious BS, because this whole whatever was the Muhammad's thing with submission to God, you submit or you will deal with your sins. So that was imposed that as in the requirement. It says this will not be our fault, and that the deaths and damages received from such, if you don't submit, will be your fault and not that of His Majesty, nor mine, nor of the gentleman who came with me. So that they were insanely putting that back onto the people, which is coming from this religious bullshit of, if you do not submit to Allah or to God, then that will be your fault, because you're not in line with the God. You're not in line with the holiness. So that's your fault and that's your sin. Now that was then imposed on the peoples. And Seed writes, the requirement was a ritual, a protocol for conquest. Whether Spanish conquerors believed in it or found it personally compelling or convincing was irrelevant. What mattered was that the political and religious leaders of their society demanded its implementation. Rituals do not automatically create community or signify an interior state of belief. Rituals are requirements, and in this case, formal political protocols that had to be followed to legitimate Spanish political rule over the indigenous people of the New World. They were persuasive to political leaders of Spain and hence had to be executed by conquerors desiring official recognition. But beyond the fundamental character of the demand, acknowledge religious superiority or be warred upon, there was a further element of Islamic inspiration. So that goes on and on. But the key thing there, I think, is that this still goes on today in the U.S. because we have people who follow along the rituals, whether it's voting or certain holidays or this or that, the flag waving. They may not even believe in, did you know that your government is giving billions of dollars to abet a genocide in against the Palestinians? So they're the people that go along with the rituals, they might be ignorant of what that is connected with. Another thing that was a highlight for me is that the underlying extremist psychology, and what I mean by that is that there's, in you know, it's nothing new, but it really stood out to me. These biblical quotes about smiting, and here's one: unless you do this, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them. So this is the prescription of this under this religious backing to overcome the godless peoples, that if they don't submit, then that's permission to thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them. Now it sounds extremist and absurd, but that is the protocol nowadays as expressed by I think it's Gallant, one of the Israeli IDF people. I think he might have been relieved of his duties. But anyway, Netanyahu and the other nut jobs, it's like that is part of their protocol, is to wipe out the Palestinians. this has been the writing in the books says that this is okay to utterly destroy them. And to my happiness, there is the Jewish interpretations of some of these things are far less combative. Neither eventual conversion nor submission to a superior religion played any role in Jewish interpretations. So I won't go into that too much, but just had to throw that in. And another doozy, just on the act of responding defensively, like they could just say, oh, well, we need to respond defensively to threats. Then she says, Christianity thus covertly introduced and legitimated the popular idea of revenge as a justification for war. So it seems like before that, you know, a war was so-called legitimate, fight versus fight. But nowadays, is like any little drop of the hat kind of thing can be used as a defensive threat. So there's a justification. While the dominant trend within medieval Christianity envisioned warfare as merely defense, a less influential group of theologians and canonists beginning in the 11th century accepted the use of force for religious purposes. And she mentions the originator of the requirement, Palacios Rubios, and its connection with Deuteronomy. Neither Jewish interpreters nor Christians from outside the Iberian Peninsula invoked Deuteronomy to justify war that sought eventual conversion. But, yet, the originator of the requirement, Palacios Rubio, cited precisely the section of Deuteronomy 20:10-16 as his biblical authority for drawing up the text. And here's something that the Spanish jurists and Palacios Rubios employed in the words of the requirement's originator. The names of the island, the natives of the island may justly defend themselves from the Christians until they discover the truth, having it explained to them how the care of the whole world and the power over it resides in the Pope, who made a donation and concession of the province in which they live to His Majesty, whom they must obey as the divine trustee of the Church. And thus they are obliged to admit, blah, 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 they may be invaded and conquered, reduced by force of arms, have their possessions seized and their persons placed in slavery because war on the part of the Christians is justified. This is like the doctrine of Christian discovery and domination. It's just a total megalomaniacal recipe for insanity and domination. And this is a unique Iberian understanding of democracy, of Deuteronomy. Freudian slip there. Those who war on infidels, non-believers, mimic Muhammad. Now here's part of the rift here. Islam as a single unitary God is strongly opposed to Trinitarian doctrines. So eventually the rift between the Christian and the Islamic is what led to that rewording from the requirement to the vassals. I'll get to it. Obedience and vassalage. And also she says the requirement was neither the standard Western or Catholic declaration of war, nor the Orthodox Islamic summons to surrender to Allah, but a new form, a hybrid, one which contained mixed within a single utterance, two styles, two belief systems. And again, the requirement proved to be an enduring means of creating political authority. It was used to legitimate dominion over large native empires in the Americas, well, not about empires, but anyway, in the Americas as expeditiously as it had over a small number of Caribbean outposts. And this started a big time around 1511. So that's the requirement was created in 1511 when there were only Spanish settlements on three islands in the Caribbean, Jamaica, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico. So that was sort of like the testing grounds that then became, you know, the rest of the of that. In 1573, Spanish officials forbade the use of the term conquest, requiring the neologism pacification to describe military efforts against indigenous peoples. Pacification removed the association with the word struggle, jihad. In addition, the formal title of the requirement was eliminated. After 1573, the formal summons to Christianity was to go by a different name, an instrument of obedience and vassalage, thus severing the linguistic association with the Islamic origins of it. As before, indigenous peoples were all only offered submission. They were obligated to respond by having received the holy faith and given us obedience. Well, that is no true choice, so offered only submission. Yet one major repercussion of the requirement was far harsher than under Islam. As innumerable commentators have pointed out, the Catholic kings Ferdinand and Isabel began a period of religious intolerance on the Iberian Peninsula. Members of religious minorities who had been tolerated there for centuries were expelled. Jews were exiled in 1492, Muslims in successive waves in the next century. Submission to Catholicism came to signify accepting of Spanish political authority. This linking of obedience to religious authority with political obedience led to the Catholic king's only important modification of the policy regarding treatment of defeated peoples. What became the option for evasion in the New World was cultural conversion. Only by shedding native dress, language, and or residence, or by marrying non-tribute payers could Indians avoid the demands of Spanish tribute. The escape hatch of religious assimilation under Islam became the predominant escape hatch of cultural and linguistic assimilation in the New World. So again, I've heard that from Native friends. Like, if you say the right things, then you'll be allowed to speak at this venue as a Native or an Indian. But if you say the things that they do not want to hear, then you don't get the rewards for submission. Another thing that came to mind listening to this was how I had no clue that the U.S. Empire is thrice influenced by the Abrahamic religions now. So obviously the Christianity and in the modern times, the Jewish, the partnering with Israel is one of the biggest examples. And now I learned that also the Islamic, which is again ironic because of the whole premise of the war on the war of terror, as I don't like to call it. The global war of terror was against the Islamics. So it's all this insane, like, it really makes me go, what the F is going on with the Abrahamic religions, and how did this stuff get to be so freaking dominant? The last two pages of the chapter is comparisons. I'll read this bit because this touches into the rewards for submission resulting from an early struggle over creating Spain's legal authority over the New World. The ritual speech known as the requirement became the principal means of enacting such authority. Every Spaniard encountering peoples who had never heard of Christianity was required to summon them to a new religion. Unlike the sometimes improvised quality of French speeches, the Spanish ritual was carefully and explicitly proscribed. Its content threatened with war those who failed to submit and promised those who did submit honors and advantages. That's the rewards for submission. These so-called honors and advantages were economic and political forms of subordination originally developed by Islamic rulers of the Iberian Peninsula. Payment of a tax, jizya, or a tribute, and the creation of quasi-independent self-governing communities, the so-called republics of Indians. They were honors and advantages only relative to slavery. They were honors and advantages only relative to slavery. But the conviction that religious and political obedience were equivalent was not part of France's historic tradition. But for the Spanish conquest, religious and political obedience were one and the same. And another subtlety to this is that it wasn't the requirement had nothing to do with consensual relationship. It was only to obtain external compliance. And another bit of summoning natives to submission, the central political ritual of Andalusi Islamic warfare. And to read the last paragraph of the chapter, when the conquest of the New World began, many Spaniards had directly experienced a war aimed at eventual conversion of people of a different faith. Spanish forces had been battling Islamic ones until 1491, the year before Columbus reached America. By contrast, in Portugal, by the start of colonization, such frequent encounters with Islamic military rituals belonged to a remote past. The last Muslims had been conquered by 1250, and the residual Islamic population was quiescent. Yet, while Islamic military rituals were not as important for Portugal's overseas adventures as for Spain's, Portugal's Islamic heritage was equally significant. for it was in Portugal that Islamic sciences, elaborated through Jewish interpreters, provided first Portugal and then the rest of the world with the navigational expertise that made possible the expansion of Europe. That navigational expertise rested upon the heritage of medieval Islamic achievements in mathematics and astronomy. Not surprisingly, the rituals of Portuguese possession in the New World were initially astronomical. So that's the gets into the next chapter. News to me how much the Islamic mathematics and astronomy has affected the domination of the peoples here. And so the next chapter is A New Sky and New Stars, Arabic and Hebrew Science, Portuguese Seamanship, and the Discovery of America. So it's fascinating stuff. Also, I have to say, fascinating BS. The level of just, as John Trudell would say, the perception of reality, how our perceptions of reality have been shaped by these things, which you can analyze and you can discuss, but when it gets to the core of it, it's just blatant insanity and blatant, as I mentioned before, blatant underlying extremist psychology. That is to me the underpinning. It's like a reason why people sort of ignore getting into the whole religious fighting, because underneath it is this vicious underlying extremist psychology to eliminate others who do not go along with the religion. And that's not to say that all of the religion is like that. I know many very cool and friendly and intelligent, you know, Christian people that are friends, and people from other traditions who are friends. And so it's not to diss the entire religion, but the religion based on these, some of the things that are mentioned in this chapter, is truly insane. And that is what is part of this prescription that we are trying to, part of this system of domination, that at least talking about it helps to raise some awareness to get out from under it, and to unravel it and let it fade off on its own, let it shrivel up and fade away. So meanwhile, enjoy the summer blossomings and greenery. Thank you for listening, and be well.